So as we saw in the last video, Psalms 9 and 10 are two separate Psalms in the Hebrew Bible, which is the ordering that most English Bibles used by Protestants follow. But in the Septuagint, the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament, Psalms 9 and 10 were one Psalm together. They were just Psalm 9. And there were reasons that people proposed for this, because Psalm 9 ends with the word Selah, that signals a pause rather than the end of a Psalm, because Psalms typically don't end with Selah. However, Psalm 3, as a viewer pointed out, which I had just kind of had a brain fart and forgot about, we had already covered that here on the channel, Psalm 3 does end with Selah. So that's at least one other example. So that's not an airtight argument for putting these two Psalms together. But other arguments were that the Psalms share a lot of imagery and vocabulary, which is true. And so to me, the most we can say is, just like Psalm 1 and 2, Psalms 9 and 10 are meant to be read together. Whether they were originally one song or not, it doesn't really change much how you read them. If you follow the Septuagint reading or if you read them in the Hebrew order, you come out with the same thing. And we saw how Psalm 9 was all about the psalmist declaring that God will do justice, about the evildoers and the wicked people who commit injustice and persecute the righteous. The psalmist was declaring the type of God God is. And in Psalm 10, it's going to focus a little bit more on what exactly these evildoers are doing, and it's going to basically lament that God seems like he's far away. So with the two Psalms, you get very much kind of a high and then a low. So as always, we're going to read the Psalm, and then we're going to take a quick tour through it. And just to remind you, I know you get tired of hearing people on YouTube say this, but it really does make or break YouTube channels. If you haven't already subscribed, please consider doing that. And when you do, enable notifications. That's how you know when Disciple Dojo videos come out. And these teaching videos that we do, they don't get as many views on YouTube because YouTube doesn't think as many people want to see these as do study Bible reviews or interviews with famous scholars. And I'm sure that's correct. I'm sure more people are interested in the other stuff, but these teaching videos are a big part of what we do here at Disciple Dojo, what we've always been doing from the very beginning. And we have videos that teach through a number of books in the Bible. They're in the playlists here on the channel. So if you've never checked out our playlist, after this video, tap the little playlist button and it'll show you all the different playlists, all the teaching series that we've done here at Disciple Dojo. All of that is made possible by people subscribing, liking, watching, sharing, commenting, doing all the things that help make a ministry with an online aspect successful. So really appreciate those of you that do that. Okay, let's jump into Psalm 10. As always, I'm going to read it in the old NIV, and then we're going to look at it in the original text and then how different translations handle different parts of it. There are a number of places in this Psalm where translations differ widely, because there honestly are a lot of uncertainties as to how the Hebrew of this psalm should be translated. And so we'll look at those as we go, but let's read it. Psalm 10. There's no superscription on this one, which is another reason why people think it originally was not a separate psalm. It begins, "Why, O Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In his arrogance, the wicked man hunts down the weak who are caught in the schemes he devises. He boasts of the cravings of his heart. He blesses the greedy and reviles the Lord. In his pride, the wicked does not seek him. In all his thoughts, there's no room for God. His ways are always prosperous. He's haughty, and your laws are far from him. He sneers at his enemies. He says to himself, 'Nothing will shake me. I'll always be happy and never have trouble.' His mouth is full of curses and lies and threats. Trouble and evil are under his tongue. He lies in wait near the villages. From ambush, he murders the innocent, watching in secret for his victims. He lies in wait like a lion in cover. He lies in wait to catch the helpless. He catches the helpless and drags them off in his net. His victims are crushed. They collapse. They fall under his strength. He says to himself, 'God has forgotten.' He covers his face and never sees. Arise, Lord. Lift up your hand, O God. Do not forget the helpless. Why does the wicked man revile God? Why does he say to himself, 'He won't call me to account'? But you, O God, do see trouble and grief. You consider it to take it in hand. The victim commits himself to you. You are the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked and evil man. Call him to account for his wickedness that would not be found out. The Lord is king forever and ever. The nations will perish from his land. You hear, O Lord, the desire of the afflicted. You encourage them and you listen to their cry, defending the fatherless and the oppressed, in order that man, who is of the earth, may terrify no more. So a number of those terms and ideas should sound familiar from the last video. Whether these were originally one psalm or two, they do go together. That's undeniable. And I particularly like the way Michael Wilcock puts it in his section, in his commentary from the Bible Speaks Today series, The Message of the Psalms. In commentating on both of these psalms, he says, when we describe Psalm 9 as positive and Psalm 10 as negative, which he does earlier in the commentary, we might almost be speaking in photographic terms. Like a photographic negative. The two panels picture the same circumstances, but one is bright with dark shadows, that was Psalm 9, and the other dark with bright gleams, and that's Psalm 10. And he goes on to say that this doesn't really make sense. If somebody was concerned with making like a pious or an uplifting poem, that naturally they should move from the darkness of experience, which is what Psalm 10 is focused on, to the light of faith, which is what Psalm 9 was about. But Wilcock says David knew otherwise. He had enough ups and downs in his life to recognize how often they come in that order. And you do see this in David's life. I mean, David's life begins on high notes and it ends on very low notes. The overall trajectory of David's life is kind of played out in many in Psalms 9 and 10. And we saw in Psalm 9, at the end of Psalm 9, it ended with this call, Arise, Yahweh, Kuma, Adonai, let Anosh, human or humanity or a person, let Anosh not be strong and let nations be judged upon your face. In other words, let nations be judged in your presence. Set fear upon them. Let nations know that they are Anosh. There's the word right there. And there it is again. So nations and Anosh. Nations and mortal or human, mere human, however different translations will handle it. That's the note that Psalm 9 ends on. And then Psalm 10 goes from this kind of confident proclamation or this pleading of what he wants God to do to a cry of lamentation. Why, Yahweh, do you stand far away? Lama Adonai, why do you stand at a distance? And then the next line, Ta'alim, you hide yourself. This is a hifil, it's reflexive. You hide yourself for times butzara. So batzara can mean trouble, it can mean drought. Either way, when the psalmist needs God, God seems to be standing off in a distance. That's how this psalm begins. This is a complete lament. And it's not just a general type of affliction or a drought, like a natural drought, or just this generic notion of trouble. No, he tells us in verse 2, in arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the afflicted. And this verb, yidlak. Now, this word, yidlak, comes from the verb dalak, and it has a meaning, a basic meaning of burn or to inflame. And it's figuratively used of either pursuing or persecuting. And that's how some translations handle it. Lexham English, in arrogance, the wicked persecutes the poor. King James goes with persecutes the poor. The JPS brings out the literal meaning, through the pride of the wicked, the poor is hotly pursued. The updated Tanakh translates it, the wicked in his arrogance hounds the lowly. And the Septuagint, interestingly, preserves this fire imagery. It says, when the ungodly one is arrogant, the poor one is burned. So that's the idea of what's going on. I actually like how Eugene Peterson handles it. He preserves this heat notion well. He says, full of hot air, the wicked are hot on the trail of the poor. That's a pretty good way of bringing that idea into English and preserving some of the literalness. But here again, we see a couple of words that are familiar from the last song, the wicked, rasha, and the afflicted or the poor or the needy, lani. And this is what the psalmist is mostly complaining about in this psalm. He's crying out to God saying, you have wicked people doing wicked things to people who are afflicted, who are persecuted, who are poor, who are downtrodden. That's what the psalmist is so upset about. Unlike other psalms, this isn't about like, oh, my reputation is being slandered or someone's telling lies about me. This is ratcheted up a notch. This is crimes against humanity. The psalmist is complaining about wanton evil, about people being oppressed. And it's going to get worse as the psalm goes. Now, there's some ambiguity in how we read verse 2. The first part's pretty clear. In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the afflicted. So far, so good. The next line, though, we don't know who these theys are. that are spoken up. So it says they will be trapped in schemes which they have woven. So this could be read as they, meaning the poor, the afflicted, the ani, will be trapped in schemes which they, the arrogant wicked, have woven or have devised. Literally, it's the word for to weave. Or you could possibly read it as a glimmer of hope on the part of the psalmist, just like he ended the previous psalm about God will judge the nations when he does arise and this is their fate. You could read this as possibly they, the arrogant wicked, will be trapped in schemes which they, the arrogant wicked, have woven. In other words, the very schemes that they have devised, they're going to be trapped in those. So you could read that as what this verse is saying. It's ambiguous. But what argues for the second reading is earlier in Psalm 9, verse 16, 15 in English, it said, nations sunk in a pit they made, in a net which they hid, their feet got trapped. So the idea of like the evil that evildoers do is going to come back to bite them. That is a pretty strong argument, I think, for reading this verse 10:2 in that same manner. But I think sometimes things are ambiguous in scripture because they're meant to be ambiguous, especially in poetry. And so I've just left all the pronouns as third person plural. They will be trapped in schemes which they have woven. And then he goes on to talk more about the rasha, the wicked. For a wicked one boasts about his soul's craving or the desire of his life, the things that the wicked has amassed, the greed, the wicked boasts about it. And one unjustly gaining, like getting something through unjust means. Berek, he blessed. In other words, not just the greedy is boasting about his own greed, but about the one, maybe his fellow wicked, who's gaining things through unjust means. He's blessing it. He's saying, hey, yeah, way to go. But he despised Ne'etz, Yahweh. Now, that's one way to read this line. I told you in this psalm, there's a lot of ambiguity in how these are translated. But you can also read it because this word barak, the verb to bless, it's one of those words in Hebrew that, like in English slang, if you say something's bad, like in the 80s, that was a way of saying something's really good. Well, in Hebrew, the word bless has that same purpose. Sometimes bless means literally to bless, like to pronounce something as good. Sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes it means to curse. Close parallel in Southern vernacular here in the South, we might say, bless your heart. Well, we aren't really praying a blessing on your heart. And so because of that, you could translate this line as well as the greedy one, that one acquiring through unjust means, the greedy one cursed, despised Yahweh. And so there's no and here, but this is poetry, so you don't always need to follow the exact grammar. And so it could be translated something like the greedy one cursed and despised Yahweh. You could also read it as, and the one unjustly gaining, or the greedy one, he blessed. In other words, the greedy person blessed his fellow greedy people, and Yahweh despised. In other words, in Hebrew, verb comes before subject. So Yahweh could be the subject. So it might be Yahweh despised. So he blessed, Yahweh despised. So this explains the different translations. Lexham English, and the one greedy for gain curses and treats Yahweh with contempt. So they're taking barak as to curse, and then this despise or treat with contempt, it's the wicked is doing it to Yahweh. But the King James translates it as, and bless the covetous, like he blesses the greedy. So it takes it as blessing, not curse, whom the Lord abhorreth. So it's taking the Lord as the subject. The Lord is the one abhorring, despising the greedy. JPS, and the covetous vaunteth himself. So JPS is taking it as the greedy person blesses himself, like raises himself up, though he contemn the Lord. In other words, but he has contempt for God. And the Tanakh says the grasping man reviles and scorns the Lord. So you have all those ranges of translations just in these few examples. The Septuagint, the one doing wrong blesses himself. So the Lord is not even in the Septuagint's translation. So this would be a textual question. Is the Septuagint translating, or is the Septuagint working from a previous Hebrew edition that is not reflected in the Masoretic tradition. This is where you'd have to really get into the weeds and scour the commentaries and talk to Psalms scholars and see what they think. For the most part, the more modern translations, RSV and RSV, ESV, they all go with something like, "And the man greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. The one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord." Now, the Message completely paraphrases, "The wicked are windbags, the swindlers have foul breath." I'm not sure which text Peterson is trying to paraphrase here, honestly. Sometimes Message verses nail it and really bring out the original text into modern English. Sometimes, I don't know what Peterson was thinking. This would be one of those times. So however you translate verse 3, verse 4 continues on describing the Rasha, the wicked. It says, "The wicked one, Rasha, according to his pride, doesn't seek." That's literally what it says. This is a fun figure of speech in Hebrew. Literally, it's like the height of his nose, or according to the upliftedness of his nose. That's the image of pride, is uplifted nose. But according to his uplifted nose, his haughtiness, his looking down on everyone, Baal Yidrosh, he doesn't seek. Now, there's nothing that says what he doesn't seek. Contextually, it's he doesn't seek God, because the next line will parallel it. It says, "There is no God in all his schemes." That's how we know that what's not being sought is God's will, God's guidance, what God thinks about it. The wicked is just scheming. How can they do more of what they want to do at the expense of the afflicted? And then the psalmist is crying out. It doesn't seem fair. Verse 5, "All his ways prosper at all times." Like, this guy's always winning. He's wicked. He's greedy. He's gained what he has through unjust means, and yet he always seems to win. What is going on, God? Proverbs tells us that, no, righteousness should be rewarded, wickedness should be punished. But right now, what I'm seeing is not matching up with how things should be. And so I'm telling you, God, that's the sense that we get in this psalm. All his ways prosper. And then this phrase literally is high, marom, or uplifted, or way up there, far high is the basic sense of it. "Your judgments from before him," minegdo. So literally from in front of him, or possibly from beside him, or from near him, or from, that's why I just say from before him. But the sense is your judgment, like your justice, mishpatecha, is way up there, and his wickedness is down here. In other words, things are not being done on earth as they are in heaven. And while that's happening, carrying over this sort of courtroom theme, all his enemies, or all the ones who oppose him, all the enemies of the wicked person, he witnesses against them. So they should be witnessing against him, and he should be the one facing God's mishpat, his justice. But he's the one who's bringing the charges. He's the one who's witnessing against his enemies, and he's prospering. Remember, his enemies are the poor, the afflicted. Now, this verb, yapiach, it could be he witnesses. It can also be translated he breathes or snorts or puffs upon, like in the literal sense. And that explains the different ways that this verse is translated. Lexham English, "Your judgments are aloof from him." That's how they render high, marom, as aloof, which I like that. That's a good way to put it. "As for all his enemies, he scoffs at them." So they're taking yapiach as scoffing, puffing, breathing. King James translates it, "Thy judgments are far above, out of his sight. As for all his enemies, he puffeth at them." The Tanakh translates it, "Your judgments are far beyond him. He snorts at all his foes." My family used to own a pug, Snortin' Norton, and so I can't read the word snorts without thinking of what we would call Norton, as his little fat self was snorting all around the house. So this just makes me think of a pug. But the idea is similar to scoffs, like snorts, like, psh, what are they going to do? Think of, if you remember Napoleon Dynamite, and you remember Summer Wheatley's boyfriend, the bully that would pick on Napoleon. Remember how he was always like snorting and sneering, and, you know, it's just one of the most ridiculous performances ever in a movie. So memorable, so obnoxious, which probably was the whole point. That's the image that the psalmist is getting at here. But the arrogant wicked is not concerned with God's justice. And that's the key thought in all of this. Because verse 6, he said in his heart, the wicked has said, "I'll not be shaken," literally, "to generation and generation, asher lo bara," which not in disaster. The thought is generations can come and go. there's not going to be any ra for the wicked. That's what the wicked is saying in his heart. So L-E-B, I shall not be moved throughout all generations, during which I will have no trouble. That's how they're rendering that phrase. JPS, I who to all generations shall not be in adversity. Or the Tanakh, through all time, never be in trouble. The Septuagint translates it pretty literally. From generation to generation, I will be without evil. Or the CSB, from generation to generation, I will be without calamity. So why am I spending so much time showing you how these different translations handle this? Because the Psalms are Hebrew poetry. Remember that. And poetry can be handled in different ways. It's not straight grammar. And so bringing poetry from one language into another is hard, and it involves interpretive decisions. And this is why, of all the genres of scripture that you should be comparing multiple translations when studying, I mean, you should be doing that for every scripture that you study, but particularly for those parts of scripture that are written in poetic genre. So the wisdom books, the Psalms, the prophets. It's super important, because if you don't read Hebrew, sometimes if you just read one translation, whichever one your favorite is, you can miss the fuller meaning or the nuance of a particular passage. Or you may end up building some theology off of a specific English translation of one translation, rather than seeing, okay, how do all these different translations handle this? And when you're studying the Bible, if you don't know the original languages and you don't have access to like an interlinear or something like that, then the best thing to do is compare translations. And you should perk up when you see, whoa, this translation used a very different word than this one. Why is that? Or this translation phrased it this way, but this one phrased it this way. Why did they make that decision? And then you start comparing other translations. Now, the beauty is, in the digital age, you can do this all on your phone. Just pull up YouVersion, pull up Step Bible, pull up Bart Bible, any of these Bible apps or Bible programs online. You have access to more English translations than most Bible readers up until about 20 years ago even knew existed. So do that when you're reading. If you have a favorite psalm, read it in whatever translation you love, but then read it in as many different translations as you can find and see if you don't notice things in it. That's why we do studies like this. That's the whole point of this series. So that's just sort of a rabbit trail. Let's get back to the Psalm, verse 7, continuing to talk about this Rasha, this wicked person. It says, oath curses. And that's the way I translated this in English, because Allah means oath, it means curse, it means imprecation, it means like not cursing like just foul language, but cursing under oath, like I swear by God, or may God strike me dead, or, you know, imprecating against, calling judgment against somebody else. This might have been, I mean, it was written in Greek, not Hebrew, but in the New Testament, when Peter denies Jesus and the people are like, no, you're one of his followers. He's like, I'm not, I don't know. And then finally it says, and he called down curses, you know, that he had never met the man. It might very well be this idea. I'm not saying it's the same word again, because Greek and Hebrew, two different languages, but just to give you an idea of what this Allah, this thing that's in his mouth is. So an oath curse, his mouth full, literally how you'd say it, and fraud, mirmoth, and oppression, vatok. So his mouth is not just filled with like these imprecatory curses, but also fraud and oppression. I mean, think of wicked politicians, powerful leaders, people that manipulate through their words, through fraud, and they use that to bring about oppression. And then in parallel to this filling his mouth, under his tongue, trouble and iniquity. Amal va'avein. This word amal can also mean toil. In Ecclesiastes, it's frequently translated as toil, but it has the meaning of toil or trouble. In Ecclesiastes, it's kind of playing on the dual meaning. In this psalm, I don't know if toil is intended in this. I think it's more focusing on the trouble meaning. But either way, trouble and avein, iniquity. That's the word for like the most serious types of sin. So that's what's under his tongue. This is what his mouth is full of. And it's not just his speech. So it's this talking about his speech. Yeah, the wicked speak out of their mouths wicked things. They use their mouths to oppress. They use the tongue to kill, to bring harm through their words. But they also do it physically. Look at verse 8. He sat in ambush of settlements. Or small villages, or, you know, lying in wait for people as they're coming and going. In secret places, he killed the innocent. His eyes lay in wait for the unfortunate. Like, this is, now we're getting into violence. And whether this is metaphorical violence, I mean, maybe in a modern setting, this might have application to like metaphorical violence, like somebody trying to ambush someone with their words or kill them by slandering their reputation or something like that. But in the ancient world, this was very literal. And this is a world before there were such thing as police. This was before most villages had walls. The ancient world was a dangerous place, especially in the time of King David in Israel. And so he's comparing him to a predator, like a literal predator. He will ambush in a secret place like a lion in his den. He will ambush to catch the poor, the afflicted. He will catch the poor when he pulls in his net. So the imagery is like of a lion waiting for his prey, and it shifts into imagery of a hunter pulling in his prey. So both of these are predatory images. And then verse 10, this is the most difficult verse in the psalm to translate. And the reason is because the text is not clear what it actually says. You have a kathiv kare issue. And if you don't know what that is, kathiv is what's written, like in the Masoretic text, the word that's written in the text. And then out to the side, sometimes when the Masoretic scholars were like, there's an error here. And we don't know when it got incorporated into the text, but it should, even though the letters say this, that doesn't really make sense. They should be read this way. And sometimes it's minor, like this is just a difference of like what tense is the verb. Is it a imperfect? Is it a perfect? Like, is it he will or he did? Either way, it doesn't matter. So I've just translated it as a without a time factor, as he crushes. And it's from this verb daka, to crush, to grind, to pulverize. He cowers and he falls. The question is this talking about the ani or the rasha? Is this talking about the afflicted? Is the afflicted the one who is like crushed down or you know, he's been dragged in a net? He's being pulverized. He's being crushed. Or is this the rasha, the wicked crushes? Like the wicked is the one doing the crushing in this verb. And because of that, these next two verbs are describing what the ani experience. He cowers, he falls. This is very ambiguous. And then the next line is even more ambiguous. It says, literally, in his strengths or mights, it's plural. And then the next word in the kathiv, what's written is the miserable ones. So literally, in his strengths, the miserable ones. What does that mean? Well, the Masoretes thought that's actually not how this should be read. Instead of helkaim as one word, the Kare reading says basically you should separate this into two different words. Chael, which is the word for army, kaim, and that's timid ones. So instead of one word, the miserable ones, it should read an army of timid ones. So that explains why these translations are going to vary so widely on verse 10. L.E.B., he is crushed, he is bowed down, so the helpless host falls by his might. So they're taking that Kare reading, helpless host or helpless army falls by his might. So all of the poor people that this person has crushed, has made bow down by his might, who have fallen by his might. So that's how L.E.B. handles it. King James, he croucheth and humbleth himself, that the poor may fall by his strong ones. So they're taking this as bowing down is not talking about the poor being brought down, like being cowed, but the person humbling himself. Not exactly sure how that fits with the rest of the psalm and the description of the arrogant wicked. At no point in the psalm does the arrogant ever humble himself, but that's how the JPS reads it. He croucheth, he boweth down, and the helpless fall into his mighty claws. They're taking that as a metonymy for his claws. So like his mighty ones are literally his claws carrying on the lion imagery. Maybe possible. The updated Tanakh, he stoops, he crouches, and the hapless fall prey to his might. The Septuagint, he will make him lowly, he will stoop down and fall when he gains dominion over the poor. RSV, the hapless is crushed, sinks down, and falls by his might. In RSV, they stoop, they crouch, and the helpless fall by their might. ESV, the helpless are crushed, sink down, and fall by his might. HCSB, so he is oppressed and beaten down, the helpless fall because of his strength. And then the CSB, so he is oppressed and beaten down, helpless people fall because of the wicked one's strength. So verse 10, there's a lot of ambiguity here, and the translators are doing their best to render this Hebrew into English that makes sense to us. I've just left it literal. He crushes, he cowers, and he falls. In his mites, or mighty ones, the miserable ones. The afflicted are miserable because they're in the power, under the might, crushed, bowed down by the wicked. That's my best take on what this verse is saying. And so earlier in verse 6, you know, he said in his heart, I'll never be shaken, generation to generation, no bad's going to happen. He's not done talking in his heart. Verse 11, he said in his heart, God forgot, he hid his face, he is forever not seeing. So the wicked is saying in his heart, this is why I can do what I do, because God's not holding me to account for any of this. And so now the psalmist responds after describing what's going on in the wicked's mind and what the wicked is doing, what the situation is. And then just like he did toward the end of Psalm 9, he cries out again, Kuma Adonai, arise, Lord God, lift your hand. Like, God, get up, do something about this. Do not forget. He's saying you forgot. Don't forget. Why is the wicked scorned God? Well, we just saw verse 11. He said in his heart, God forgot. He says in his heart, you will not investigate. You will not seek, literally to seek, but in this sense, meaning to investigate, to look into. God's not going to look into it. The wicked one said, God forgot. He hid his face. He's forever not seeing. God's not going to look into any of this. And that's exactly what the psalmist is crying out. He's saying, you're not going to investigate. Do you hear what he's saying, God? But verse 14, the psalmist says, you do see. For trouble and vexation, you yourself observe. And this is emphatic in Hebrew, but the word order is a little different. So literal word order is ki ata, because you, amal v'ka'as, trouble and vexation, tabit, you observe. Now, tabit is the word for you observe. But when ata is put here, that's the word for you. So it's like the psalmist is saying, you yourself, the wicked says you're not seeing it, but God, you are seeing. It's an emphatic. And this is interesting to me because amal v'ka'as, trouble and vexation, these are two terms that are found very frequently in Ecclesiastes. In fact, these are two of the more important terms in the book of Ecclesiastes. And I spent the last couple of years in Ecclesiastes, so these words stuck out to me. I'm like, oh, that's a little bit of the same thing that Qohelet in Ecclesiastes was observing and lamenting. So kind of a cool connection between a psalm and some of the wisdom literature. But God sees, God's observing the trouble and vexation to give into your hand or to put into your hand. Upon you, the poor will abandon himself. An orphan, you have been helping. And this word, helping, ozer, this is the same word that the word for woman when she's created as an ezer, that's translated as a helper. This is that same verb, just in a participle form. God has been helping the orphan. So again, when we come to Hebrew that's sort of awkward, it's always good to see how different translations handle it. Here's how they have, L-E-B. But you have seen, indeed you have noted, trouble and grief to take it into your hand. The helpless abandons himself upon you. You have been the helper for the orphan. JPS, thou hast seen, for thou beholdest trouble and vexation to requite them with thy hand. Unto thee the helpless committeth himself. Thou hast been the helper of the fatherless. Updated Tanakh. You do look. You take note of mischief and vexation. To requite is in your power. To you the hapless can entrust himself. You have ever been the orphan's help. In the Septuagint, you see, for you will perceive distress and anger to give them over into your hands. Therefore, the poor one has been abandoned to you. For the orphan, you are a helper. And the RSV and RSV and ESV, they're very similar. Some have trouble and vexation. In RSV, trouble and grief. ESV, mischief and vexation. But all of them have, that's what God takes into his hands. To you, the helpless commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. In RSV, you have been the helper of the orphan. In the CSV, but you yourself have seen trouble and grief. Observing it in order to take the matter into your hands. So a little more thought for thought rather than literal. The helpless one entrusts himself to you. You are a helper of the fatherless. And so verse 15, the psalmist cries, break the arm of the wicked. Literally, shabor, break, shatter the arm of the wicked. And arm is a figure of speech in Hebrew Bible for power or might. You know, when a king rescues someone, it will frequently talk about with his mighty arm or with his strong arm. And so break the arm of the wicked. I mean, this isn't talking about like a jujitsu arm bar. This is like stop the ability of the wicked to carry out their wickedness. And the evil, vara, you could also translate this and the trouble or and the disaster. Ra is a general word. Sometimes it means trouble. Sometimes it means disaster, calamity. Sometimes it means actual moral evil. But this badness, ra, a good way of thinking of it is just bad. And the bad, investigate risho, his wickedness. And then the last phrase of this verse in Hebrew is weird. It just says, bal timtza. Literally, it says, you will not find. So there's a few ways to take it. And evil, investigate his wickedness until you don't find any more of it or until there's not any. That's how I'm taking it. That's also how a number of the other translations take it. LEB, seek out his wickedness until you find none. King James, seek out his wickedness till thou find none. This until or till, that's not in the Hebrew text. That's, again, you're taking poetry and trying to put it into another language. So no matter how literal you want to be, you have to add words sometimes to make it make sense. The JPS follows suit, search out his wickedness till none be found. The Tanakh takes it a little bit differently. Oh, break the power of the wicked and evil man so that when you look for his wickedness, you will find it no more. The Septuagint, crush the arm of the sinner and evil one. His sin will be sought for and he will not be found because of it. So because his sin was searched out, he's not going to be found because of it. In other words, he'll be judged. He'll be destroyed because of his sin, which is why he won't be able to be found. ESV, call his wickedness to account till you find none. The Holman Christian had call his wickedness into account until nothing remains of it. But then the updated CSB has until you look for his wickedness, but it can't be found. But the Psalm does not end on a note of despair. It ends just like Psalm 9 did, noting God being the judge of the nations and the one who will do right on the earth. Verse 16, Yahweh, King forever and ever. The nations perished from his land. And remember, in this psalm, the nations, it's not just talking about like ethnic non-Israelites. The Goyim in these two psalms have been a way of referring to the ones who are opposed to God. And this could be the nations perished from his land or from his earth. The word aretz, that can be land or earth. So it could be talking about ultimate judgment, like the wicked being wiped off the earth, or it could be talking about the pagan elements, the oppressive nations that are against the people of God in the land being driven out. I think either meaning would make sense in context. And verse 17, the cravings of the poor you have heard, Yahweh. This is the word we saw earlier in the psalm near the beginning when it talked about the wicked boasting in the cravings of his soul. So the wicked boasting about his cravings to anyone who will listen. The poor crying out to God with their cravings and God hears. And not just God has heard, you firmed up their hearts. Your ears listened attentively. There's a lot of body language throughout this psalm. Arms, mouth, tongue, heart, ears. This is poetic language. It's not like God has giant ears and needs sound waves to propagate and vibrate his giant eardrums in order for him to then be able to decipher it. That's a level of wooden literalism that nobody is suggesting. And the ancients weren't dumb. They didn't think about God that way. This is a figure of speech. This is a poetic way of describing God perceiving the cries of our heart. So talking about God's ears or God's right arm or God's eyes, these are anthropomorphisms. They're not pressed for crass literalism. And just like Psalm 9 ended with the cry of Arise, God, let the human not be strong, Enosh. Let the nations know that they are human, Enosh. Psalm 10 ends similarly, to judge orphan and oppressed. And while judgment of the wicked will be horrible, judgment for the orphan and the oppressed will be wonderful. God's judgment is a double-edged sword. For those who are on the receiving end of brutality, judgment means salvation, vindication. For those who are the ones doing the brutalizing, doing the oppressing, judgment means your time is up. So how we experience God's judgment is determined by our standing with God. But because God is the one to judge the orphan and the oppressed, a person, and there's the word again, anosh, a mortal, a human, will not still continue to terrify from the land. This could also be read as, for no person will continue to be terrified in the land. Some take it that way. So because God is the one who will judge the orphan and the oppressed, a person, a human, a mortal, a nosh, the one who thinks he's something more than a mortal, will not continue still to terrify from the land. And that's kind of clunky, but that's a very literal way of saying it. The different translations, so that a mere mortal from the earth will no longer cause terror. JPS, that the man who is of the earth may be terrible no more. And the Septuagint, so a person does not proceed further to boast upon the earth. The Dead Sea Scrolls, so that people of the earth may strike terror no more. NRSV, so that those from earth may strike terror no more. ESV, so that man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. Holman Christian, so that men of the earth may terrify them no more. And then the Message, the reign of terror is over, the rule of the gang lords is ended. In this psalm, the wicked is not someone who's necessarily an atheist, like they don't believe in God. It's someone who's a practical or functional atheist. Whether God exists or not is irrelevant to them. They act as if God doesn't exist. And because of that, they don't think they're going to be brought to account for anything that they do. And Rolf Jacobson comments on this in his volume on the Psalms in the New International Commentary series. He says, the functional atheist is not concerned so much with the theoretical question as to the existence of God. Rather, he lives and behaves as if God did not exist. And so Jacobson goes on to say, the threat that practical atheists pose to both community and to powerless individuals is, and this is a typo, I think, in Accordance, it should read, is not. So if anybody from Accordance is watching, I think there's a typo here. But the threat that practical atheists pose to both community and to powerless individuals is not so much in the content of their beliefs, except to the extent that their beliefs result in actions, as in the actions that they take. Because they live their lives without the fear of God, they feel free to oppress the widow, the orphan, and the weak. Now, this is not to say that everyone who is an atheist oppresses the poor, the widow. This is not saying atheists are evil. But what this is saying is, to do those evil things, you can't believe that there is a God who's going to judge you for them. Atheists can always live better than their worldview allows for. I say this to my atheist friends all the time. You know, when they say things like, I'm compassionate, I love people, I treat people good. You don't have to believe in God to believe in good. And I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, you don't have to believe it in order to live it, but you're living on an ethic that your worldview really, at the end of the day, can't sustain. And that's a debate for another time. But the concept is one that's very much found in Scripture. If you think that there is a judge who sees everything and who will bring all things into account, that plays a part in how you relate to other people. And in biblical times, it's very rare that you would find somebody who would say there's no such thing as the divine. You know, everybody believed in gods. The question was, did they think the gods were going to actually do anything? Did they live as if the gods cared how they treated other people? So for the functional atheist, God's not paying attention. Nobody's going to stop me. I'm going to do what I want. But that brings out a very different response on the part of the psalmist. Jacobson says, contrary to the practical atheism of the wicked, the psalmist is a practical theist. The psalmist has more than merely an abstract intellectual faith in God. The psalmist lives out this faith in the concrete choices of daily life, in decisions to pray in the face of suffering, to stand firm in faith in the face of evil, and to refuse to join forces with oppression. So I love what Jacobson says next. He says, note especially that to keep faith in God means two things simultaneously. It means both to continue to trust in God's faithfulness in spite of the presence of oppression, and it means to struggle against oppression, to refuse to throw in one's lot with those who oppress the poor. See, in the psalm, both the faithful and the wicked think that God's forgotten, that he's not paying attention, that he's far away. But for the faithful, God's absence is a call to prayer. For the wicked, it's just an opportunity to continue doing more wickedness. So Psalm 10, not an easy psalm. It's not super uplifting. It's an unflinching look at oppression and evil seeming to have free reign in the world, especially against the poor and the afflicted. You can't help but feel a lot of what the psalmist is feeling anytime you scroll Facebook or Twitter. The world is full of evil. It's full of wickedness. It's full of oppression. But for the psalmist, that is all the more reason to cry out to God and to not throw in one's lot with the wicked, with the oppressor. Because in the end, God is the judge who's not going to miss anything, and everything will be brought to account. That's the hope, that's the trust, that's the faith that God's people have survived on for thousands of years and will continue to do so until Jesus returns to judge the quick and the dead. So that's all for Psalm 10. As always, if you appreciate this series, we'd appreciate you subscribing and enabling notifications, commenting, liking, sharing these videos, just helping get the word out about Disciple Dojo and this teaching series that we're doing. I hope it's helpful. Stay tuned for Psalm 11. And until then, as always, keep training.